Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news and commentary, debate, dialogue, and discussion about healthcare and science in the news. Also, we'll be answering your questions via both email and live call. So, I'll give out those numbers in just a few minutes, but before that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, as promised, I went and did a little research about this TMAO, which, by the way, stands for trimethylamine N oxide. Last week, we had an on-air question about this story, and I came up short because I had actually missed the article, which appeared in the New York Times, April 7th, 2013, suggesting that red meat is a cause of heart disease, and it's not cholesterol, it's actually L-carnitine being turned into this substance, trimethylamine N-oxide. We're going to go with the TMAO for the rest of this discussion. And the TMAO was somehow toxic to the arterial wall and led to increased atherosclerosis. Well, I'm sure it sold newspapers. It obviously got the attention of people, and somehow I think the vegan versus paleo people are shaping up to be one of those, red state, blue state sort of polarized controversies in our society. Maybe this is not such a nail in the coffin of eating meat as it appears at the first view. First of all, let me tell you about the study. It was published in Nature Medicine. Let's see, February of 2013, published online, April 7th, 2013. In this, the researchers did two things. First of all, they've been researching this trimethylamine oxide, TMAO, and they were using a mouse model for atherosclerosis, and they gave these mice large amounts of L-carnitine, which is a substance that is found in large amounts in red meat, and they were able to show that that the mice that received the large amounts of L-carnitine got atherosclerosis. They also were able to link it to TMAO by giving the mice antibiotics that knocked out their gut flora, and by destroying or eliminating the gut bacteria in the mice, they didn't see that cardiovascular risk. So that implicates the TMAO for sure, because that is made by the gut flora. So I'm fine with the chain of logic up to that point, the chain of causality. They then did a study in humans. They took a grand total of like five or six people, which is a very small N. One of those people was a vegan who had not eaten meat for a year. And for the sake of science, that courageous vegan ate a steak. And everybody had their blood tested. What they found was that in the vegan who did not have the gut flora that would be expected of a meat eater, the L-carnitine in the meat did not get converted to TMAO. Now, from this comes this huge idea that somehow it's the TMAO and therefore it's the L-carnitine, and maybe we shouldn't use L-carnitine as a supplement because it might turn into TMAO and then it's going to melt our hearts. You know, it's really kind of another problem with taking epidemiologic data and then taking some bench science and leaping the great divide between the two. There's lots of reasons to think that the consumption of fresh, unprocessed red meat is really not a problem. There's a number of large epidemiological studies that suggest that. It's also true that when you look at heart disease rates, they are lower in vegans and vegetarians in some studies. Usually the studies that are just big epidemiological, are you a vegetarian, yes, no, kind of studies. When you actually control for other behaviors like smoking and exercise and the use of, well, let's say all of the additives that come along with processed meats, with hot dogs and hamburgers, and if you get meat eaters who avoid those things, you start to lose that connection between heart disease and vegetarianism, or rather the inverse connection between heart disease and vegetarianism. it may very well be what's called the healthy user bias. And healthy user bias basically talks about the fact that wild-time humans have lots of behaviors. They're not lab animals, and you can't isolate the variables. So in the case of this issue of red meat, another study, which I found very interesting, looked at people who shop at health food stores and compared them, whether they were omnivores, and eating meat, in other words, or vegetarians, and found no difference in cardiovascular risk criteria or in outcomes. And it was a retrospective study, so it was like a 5 or 10 year retrospective study. Decent interval for an effect to manifest itself. And for the most part, I think a really good contrary argument that maybe it's about a whole set of behaviors that influence cardiovascular risk. And this search for a single factor is fueled by a mistaken understanding of how biological systems work. It's also possible that those poor health behaviors may make a big difference in terms of whether or not TMAO and a whole host of other things, including bacterial toxins, which we know are present in our intestines. If you have poor health behaviors, you are going to have a poor intestinal barrier function. If you chow down on a lot of ibuprofen and eat a lot of crap, high oxidative stress, don't exercise, don't get enough fiber, don't get enough fresh fruits and vegetables, you will have a leaky gut. And if you have a leaky gut or intestinal hyperpermeability syndrome, then more of the toxins that are present in your diet and more of the antigens that are present in food that should be kept in the digestive tract will actually leak into the bloodstream and lead to an inflammatory condition. And if there is anything we do know about cardiovascular disease, it's that it is a disease of inflammation. We went down this primrose path about diet 20 years ago or 30 years ago now with cholesterol. And we're finally figuring out. That led to a change in the recommendations. It said, well, eat lots of grains. And people ate lots of grains and they got very fat. And surprise, surprise, it actually went up. Heart disease increased. So diabetes increased. So you know what, guys? Take a deep breath. Do not be a simplistic thinker. Be a sophisticated systems thinker and realize that we have a long way to go before the causality here is anywhere near established on this TMAO and L-carnitine connection. I don't recommend the vitamin waters. I think it's a crazy idea. I think you should drink water, but don't get creeped out on L-carnitine. The evidence just isn't there, in my opinion. We had an email from Judith in Atlanta who wrote as follows. I know how important fish is in the diet. I'm now seeing articles that support eating fish but not taking fish oil supplements. Would you please discuss this? And she cites a study that was done in Italy. And there's some problems with this study. I'm looking at the abstract right now. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Let me tell you a secret. If you want to prove that supplements don't work, here's how you do it. First of all, you choose a low dose of the supplement, and then you give it to people who are already at low risk of the event that you're trying to study. And then you can prove very easily that a low dose of supplement doesn't change outcome in low risk individuals, which you can then publish as discrediting the supplement entirely. And that's pretty much what this study did. They used a trivial dose of fish oil. They used a 1 gram dose. And it doesn't state anywhere in the abstract or the methods section what the EPA content of that fish oil was. And you can get fish oil supplements that would give you maybe a gram might give you 50, 150 milligrams of EPA, which is a trivial dose. Even at 500, that's not the dose that we know works head-to-head against Lipitor. We do have that study. We do know the dose. You need about 2,000 to 3,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA to get a cardiovascular protective effect. So why didn't the researchers in Italy use that dose? Well, beats me. The other problem with this study is that the group that they studied was a low-risk group. These were people who were already taking aspirin and statins. So in order to see a difference between the people taking the fish oil and the people not taking the fish oil, you would have had to probably have 100,000, even if that was an adequate dose, which, as I've already stated, I don't think it was. This study proves nothing. And it seems to me that it might have actually been designed from the get-go to do exactly that. We're going to go to the phones now, and I want to invite you to call at 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. And we're going to go now to Diane in Seaside. Hello, Diane, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you. I have a question about radioactive iodine treatment I had, probably about 20 years ago. And then the risk of cancer, throat cancer in the future associated with that. And one other question about the throat.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Well, let's start with, we'll start with that. First of all, I presume you had the radioactive iodine because you had Graves' disease.
Yes.
Is that correct? There are really only a couple of treatments for that, an autoimmune phenomenon in which you make antibodies that activate the thyroid, effectively mimic thyroid-stimulating hormone, and that hyperthyroidism is a very dangerous disease. So we do have to treat it, and the options are radioactive iodine, removing the thyroid, or lifelong use of thyroid inhibitor drugs like tapazole that prevent the iodination of thyroglobulin. None of these three things are good, excellent choices. So I really feel you did the standard of care lesser of three evils option there. I want to say, put that out right out. You do have some increased lifetime risk, although the further out you get, the lower it is. So since you're 20 years out, you've pretty much, because there's still some potential that you got some mutations, and if you got another mutation, you could roll out with a cancer, but you're pretty much past the danger phase statistically.
Uh-huh.
So that's good. It's sort of front-loaded in terms of long-term risk.
Yes.
Then the risks are of thyroid cancer, because your thyroid was irradiated, and also of epithelial cancers of the respiratory tract, maybe the nasopharynx. I'm not sure on the data on that, but certainly the throat and mouth. Your major risk there is smoking, so you should not be a smoker. You should avoid also passive cigarette smoke exposure, because those are additionally mutagenic, and that's the thing you want to avoid, is additional mutations.
Okay. The other part associated with that is I had a really bad bout of laryngitis probably, again, maybe 15 years ago or so, and it sort of changed my voice slightly. And then I had whooping cough a couple of years ago, and it changed my voice, so it sort of cracks and is froggy often, mm-hmm. especially with stress. And I was wondering if that had any association with future throat problems.
Yeah, I think you should get your vocal cords looked at and make sure that you don't have a vocal cord nodule.
Okay.
And that's a simple test. ENT doctor does it in the office. But you should probably get your vocal cords looked at and see if there's anything that can be done for that. They've got some excellent technologies now, and this might be a structural problem that's easily cured.
Okay, that's a gastroenterologist?
No, ENT. Otorhinolaryngology, which is, we don't even like to say that, and we're doctors.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Diane. Keep listening and have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye.
And let's go now to Lynn in Capitola. Hello, Lynn, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. What can I do for you today?
I have a mother, 94-year-old mother. She just turned 94. She's fairly in good health. She has diabetes and macular degeneration. But the problem is she has osteosporosis in her shoulders, and she's been taking Oxycontin, Norco, and all these antibiotics, and they're all causing her such terrible pain. And I read about something, it was in the AARP bulletin, about a gentleman in at Harvard Institute that was starting to do work of blocking pain at the source rather than using all these narcotics in the brain. And I was wondering, one, do you know of any research this in this area that might be coming down the pipe? 94, she doesn't have much more time. And two, if I were to try and and go out and solicit these people to help me with my problem. In these research institutes, I imagine it's probably difficult, but how would I go about doing that if I wanted to try and...
Okay, well, I would start with the fact that because of your mother's advanced age,
mm-hmm.
she's probably going to be excluded from any research protocol.
Okay.
Just because her, at 94, her probability of dying is mm-hmm. fairly high, from natural causes.
Yeah.
But if she were to do that in the middle of a research protocol, it really messes up your statistics.
Okay.
And so you,
yeah.
when you're trying to, for example, if you're trying to prove something is safe, mm-hmm. you don't want to enroll people who might die tomorrow from some other reason because your therapy is going to be implicated. So from a practical standpoint, most studies limit the upper age,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to 80, you know, 80 is actually a reach for most studies. So mm-hmm. she's well past that. In the local area, I'm assuming that what the reports you read were talking about is some sort of blocking occurring in the spinal column. I mean, when you say blocking pain at the source,
they talk about blocking pain in all different places. It's a great article. It's in the April of 2013, volume 54.
Why don't you send me a link or
okay.
send me the reference and I'll dig mm-hmm. it up. I'd like to read it. But let me just say that there are nerve stimulators that can be placed in the spinal column that block pain. There are also devices that can deliver intrathecal doses of analgesics. And mm-hmm. there is, in fact, in the Ask Dr. Don archives, an interview. Oh, and we're going back maybe 4 or 5 years with Dr. Lawrence Perret, who's a local pain specialist
mm-hmm.
That discusses a lot of these advanced techniques and also the physiology of wind-up, which is probably what's happened to your mother, is that her spinal column has effectively recruited other neurons
mm-hmm,
that
yes.
are normally used normally used to feel temperature, for example, and mm-hmm. are now using those neurons to transmit a bigger and bigger pain signal.
Mm-hmm.
And you really get into paint yourself into a corner with the narcotics in
right.
elders because, of course, you've got the constipation issue, you've
sure.
got the mental cognition issue,
yeah.
and you've
Depression.
Got the falls issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so in attempting to improve someone's quality of life, you end up risking their life,
yeah.
As well as setting them up for a number of unpleasant side effects.
Yeah.
So it really is a very difficult situation. Now, one of the less invasive things that I would urge you to try
mm-hmm.
is a program of aggressive acupuncture on your mother
mm-hmm.
because it is working with that neural circuitry.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that from MRI studies, we know that when you do acupuncture on the neck and, for example, on the back,
mm-hmm.
that you change pain perception in the brain. We can show
mm-hmm.
upregulation of pain reduction areas and downregulation of pain sensing areas. And there's data going back at least 15 years
mm-hmm.
With pretty pictures of brains on acupuncture that show that they resemble brains on opiates,
mm-hmm.
but without the side effects.
Yeah, we did do it, and it was effective. It was very effective, but the thing, it only lasts like 2 days. And then, I 94, she's just not capable of lasting more than like 45 minutes out in the world before she starts,
she's
very tired.
You should try the indwelling ear needles because sometimes those will hold the acupuncture effect to a more meaningful duration. You could
okay.
maybe, so there are, talk to Five Branches, give mm-hmm. my office a call, whatever,
yeah.
but keep pursuing it.
Okay.
And send me that article.
I will. I'm one of your patients, so I will give it to you.
All right. Well, that works. Okay.
Thank you so much, Dr. Don.
You're
as
welcome.
Always, you're wonderful.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Lee in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lee, and welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thanks. I want to second that. And that's the purpose of my call was to give you some feedback. 68-year-old contractor, burning on my left thigh, called a couple weeks ago, told you that the burning went away when I sat down. I believe you ruled out paralysia paresthetica and told me that probably a cortisone injection in my back is probably what would it would take care of it. So I went to the VA, talked to neurology. They said, browse your parasitic, take gabapentin and go home. And I said, that's not the way I treat my body. Thank you very much. I want a second opinion. So they sent me to another office, another neurologist, who happened to have the EMG, electrical nerve conductivity equipment in his office, just in case I needed it, they told me. And he told me at the outset, without even listening to what I had to say, that I had paralysis paresthetica. And I said, well, gee, isn't that contraindicated when it goes away when you sit down? I was told by a physician that I did not pay that that was the case. And he goes, well, you get what you pay for. You have this disease, and let's do the test. So I said, all right. So we're shocking my thigh, and my leg is twitching, and he's going, well, we're not getting anything here. And he puts some needles in, and we listen to my muscles when I contract and relax. And he says, oh, we're not getting anything here either. And I said, well, what else can you do? He says, well, let's put these needles in your back and check your back. And he goes, oh. And he goes over and he looks at a book he's got in his briefcase, which does not inspire confidence. And he comes back and he says, well, you've got a problem in your L2 or your L3 in your lower back. And we'll try traction. And if that doesn't work, you should get a cortisone injection in your back. Ba-boom. Ba-boom.
I don't, where's the sound effects, you know?
Yeah, I told him once they told me the name of the problem, I was reading. And the reading I was doing said that seating was contraindicative, seating making the pain go away, it was contraindicative to this diagnosis. And he said, well, you're doing bad reading. It was classic. I wish you could have been a little fly on the wall. You would have been in giggles the whole time.
Well, I think that I feel very happy that I was able to help you resist the sort of knee-jerk pigeonhole first reaction and get to the answer to your problem. How are you doing as far as your pain's concerned?
I still have to sit about every hour, and I'm a contractor. I'm on my feet 14, 16 hours a day. And,
have you been doing that traction?
Well, this was just 2 days ago. I'm waiting for a call back from physical therapy to get into traction to see if that's going to help. I've got an occupational injury from 1974 in that very same area mm-hmm. that was never dealt with.
Right.
I suspect it's related. No idea what the traction will work.
Well, I hope it does. And if it doesn't, then, go for that injection. Give it a shot. Thanks very much for the feedback.
Oh, you're most welcome. Keep it up.
Thank you. Bye-bye. And let's go to Marie and Salinas. Hello, Marie.
Hi.
Hi. Oh, we got you on the line now. What can I do for you today?
Well, we got quite a shocker this week. My daughter, I'm calling actually for my daughter who is in Ohio, took her one-year-old in for her well baby check and found out that she has got a blood level of 15 at 1 year old.
Oh, that's very significant. How old is the house they live in?
100 years.
Okay, there's your problem.
You think so, huh?
Absolutely. First thing out of the bat, paint, dust, there's, you check the, I had a patient recently come to me who lived in a 100-year-old farmhouse, and even though the mom was super, super careful, there was enough paint in the kitchen cupboards, and the baby would play, taking pots out of the cupboards and putting them back in and stuff like that. And anyway, the child actually had a fairly high lead level, not quite so high as your granddaughter. And that's a significant level. And for every point above 5, if it's not addressed, you can lose an IQ point. So we want to address this promptly and get her environment cleaned up. There is lead testing that can be done, and the whole house should be checked. If it was a farmhouse, there may have been an area outside where there was a lot of gasoline or diesel or leaded gasoline that could have gotten into the ground from exhaust or something like that. And so the dirt around the house should also be checked for lead.
Yeah. Well, they do this routinely in the city that she's in, with especially when it involves a young child. The city will come out at no cost and do a and test the ground and the house. So, of course, that hasn't been done yet. But does this stay in her forever?
No.
Or what can be done for her? My daughter is on a modified GAPS diet. I mean, this is the irony. She is absolutely four-square nutrition. I mean, mm-hmm. is grass-fed, organic. I mean, and to have this occur has just been absolutely devastating to her.
Okay, so a couple of things that at 1 year old you can probably start doing that will help with getting rid of lead, okay? First of all, there are drugs, and she's at a level of 15. It's would be appropriate to chelate her, to use maybe an oral chelating agent. Susamer is the one that's usually used for lead. And this is a compound that literally goes through the bloodstream, gets into the body tissues, scavenges the lead, holds onto it like a magnet, and pulls it back into the circulation where it gets processed and dumped into the urine and the feces, primarily the urine. Mm-hmm. So chelation at a level of 15 should be considered, in my opinion. It's above 10 is usually when we start thinking about it. Next thing is you've got to clean up the environment, figure out where the inputs are, because this didn't just jump into her body, it got into her body, so you have to keep more of it from getting in.
Yeah.
Dietary-wise, things that are helpful at this age are, one thing would be N-acetylcysteine, NAC, which has a kind of an off taste, so you'll have to really play around to find a form of it that you can get a one-year-old to tolerate. If it were an older child, you could give it in pills or teach them to swallow capsules. At a five-year-old, you can get a five-year-old to swallow capsules, but not a one-year-old. You wouldn't even want to attempt it. So opening capsules of N-acetylcysteine and finding what you can mix it with that the baby will eat. It's really more of an off odor than anything else. But this is a precursor to glutathione, and glutathione is what you consume when you get rid of heavy metals. So think of it as like a lead weight that you tie to this toxic, not lead weight, okay, you've got lead, but like a fishing plumb weight, you know, to drop the hook down into the water.
Yep.
And so you're putting something on that lead molecule or lead atom that will hold it in the digestive tract and keep it from getting back out into the body, back into the bone. And your bone does turn over. Lead likes to go to bone. So it'll be a couple of years of bone turnover in a clean environment, and all of that lead will leave. So
okay.
You can get rid of it. It does accumulate, but the main thing is it's been caught very early, and there's plenty of time. There's plenty of neuroplasticity left, and it's just a matter of really cleaning up that environment and figuring out where it was coming from.
Yeah.
Also, iron supplementation is very important right now, because there's studies that show that if you give iron to a lead-poisoned baby, that you mitigate the neurological damage. So she should be on iron supplementation.
Okay. Is there any particular one that you would recommend? Because I know there's iron and then there's iron.
You know, ferrous gluconate, ferrous sulfate is probably fine, easy to find. And they make a children's version. You can have ferrous fumarate made up as a liquid, but I don't think you need to go to that trouble. Just plain old Ferinsol, which is ferrous sulfate in solution, is been designed to be palatable to children. And with a one-year-old, the trick is you got to get it in.
Yeah.
And they have enough of a mind of their own at this point that they can certainly, you know, exclude food, shall we say.
Yeah, so that mitigates what again, did you say?
The neurological injury from lead, which is the thing we're most worried about, is her brain, her developing brain.
Right. Okay, great. Well, she was listening to a symposium online, and I don't remember the name, but I think it was out of, I can't even remember the name of the man.
It doesn't matter. What was the?
Well, anyway, it was a woman that was talking about crock pots and the glazing on some of the older crock pots that had a lead glaze between the stoneware and then the final glaze. And when the final glaze went off, there was exposure to this lead.
Really? Wow.
Crazy to me.
But that sounds, it sounds like a typical Homer Simpson kind of moment when industrial food production. But God, that's awful. If you can find the link, I'd love to hear it. I'd like to chase that one down because that's a substantial issue in households. I mean, you keep your crock pot forever. Why would you replace it?
Well, yeah, and she's been doing bone broth and all this stuff and so has had things sitting in crock pots for days, literally, you know, to make bone broth.
It'd be easy enough to check that because you would just get one of those swabs that lights up with lead and just kind of swab it around all over on the inside of the crock pot. Maybe use two or three of them. You could probably validate or invalidate that idea. But what an interesting
thing.
Where
do you get those?
I think you can get them at Home Depot or hardware stores. I know I've seen them, and you'd certainly get them online.
Okay.
They're little vial, and you squeeze it and break the stuff inside, and it has a cotton swab on the outside of the vial, and it just gets damp, and it does a color change if it encounters lead.
Okay. Oh, I know it was Price. Weston A. Price.
Oh, yes. Weston Price Foundation. They have a lot of very good information. Thank you for that. I will see if I can find that.
It was about a 7-day online thing, and it was in late March, I think.
Well, I'll look for it.
But it was like many, many days worth of things online.
Well, thank you so very much, Marie, for that. And I hope I've helped you with your granddaughter.
Well, you have. I'm of course, freaked out as much as a grandma can be over this, too.
Yeah.
Especially when you get online and you start reading stuff.
Yeah, I want to mention, we have a listener, a loyal listener, who's an environmental specialist, and Hal has just chimed in. And of course, I should have said this. Thank you, Hal, because he's just always got my back. I so appreciate it on these toxic issues. Plumbing, that if it's a 100-year-old house, the pipes, the water that comes out of those pipes could have lead in it.
Mm-hmm.
So got to check the plumbing.
And well, I guess the city's pretty scrupulous because, I mean, it's an older city.
No, it doesn't matter. It's if the faucet, there's lead in those old faucets. So the water that goes into the house could be pristine, but by the time it comes out of the faucet, it could be contaminated. So the way to test it is you test the water that comes out basically of the kitchen faucet and the bathroom faucet, wherever you would be drinking the water.
Yep. Now, could you test that with one of those swabs? It's going to be the city comes out.
The city will probably do that as part of their inspection. Doctors Data, which is a company that you can find online, you know, www.doctorsdata.com, has about $100, very good mineral, lead, and toxic metals testing kit. And, of course, any commercial water lab locally to them will do lead testing.
Yeah.
So you might want to not wait for the city. I don't know what kind of lag time there's going to be about getting them out there, but or maybe drink bottled water while you're waiting to test that if that's not possible.
Yeah. Well, they have a water filter on their faucet, but
out lead, I don't think.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been helpful.
Good luck to you, Marie.
Thanks.
Bye bye. And let's go now to April in Santa Cruz. Hello, April. Welcome to the program.
Well, hi, Dr. Don. I just wanted to quickly do a follow-up on the lead conversation that you just had.
Sure.
There is a product called Lead Check, and these look like little pencils with little brushes on the end. And you break them inside, and you rub them on any surface, and if they turn pink, it will show that there's lead in there.
Lead Check, is that spelled C-H-E-C-K or C-H-E-K?
C-H-E-C-K.
Okay.
And they're called Lead Check Swabs. And I'm looking at because I have a box and I check everything, and she is absolutely right. Some crock pot glazes do have lead. I even checked all my dishes with these. You just rub it on the dish if it turns pink, and then you put it on the little paper and it's pink, it means there's lead in the glaze.
This is especially important if you have secondhand dishes or dishes that you get from garage sales.
Absolutely. There's nothing I use that I don't check with my lead check swabs that I'm going to consume food off of.
That's very smart.
And you might even be able to use it on the walls with the lead in the paint. It'll show instantly if there's lead on that wall and in that paint.
Good to know.
Okay, so they're called lead check swabs.
I love that you called in to help out Marie and Salinas. Thank you so much, April, in Santa
Cruz.
Oh, you're
welcome. And these work.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
This is great. This is the kind of crowdsourcing of community, having a dialogue that I am invested in hosting here. And so I'm just having a wonderful little moment just now. Let's keep it rolling. Let's go to Miguel in Scotts Valley. Hello, Miguel. Welcome to the program. Hi.
Thank you. I'm calling because of the L-carnitine and the TMAO discussion you had.
Sure.
The China study motivated my girlfriend to go vegan. And the China study was epidemiological and lab work.
Colin Campbell, very famous work and implicating dairy products as well as red meat, I believe.
Yes. So all animal protein, dairy and meat. So my girlfriend went vegan to avoid the diseases of affluence, cancer, heart disease, stroke. So since you were questioning the conclusions of an epidemiological study plus lab work, I wanted to call in and ask, is her action reasonable, going vegan to avoid these diseases of affluence?
Well, I think that the epidemiologic data that Colin Campbell presents is persuasive, and yet at the same time, it's not conclusive. When you actually try to do studies that prove causality, you run into all of these third variable issues. Now, I do think that many people who are young and have a healthy digestive tract can do okay on a vegan diet. But as you get older, it becomes more problematic. And maybe if you are a lifelong vegan, we aren't going to see the deterioration of the digestive tract that I typically see in my patients as they age. So perhaps if you start out that way and stay that way, it doesn't happen. I don't honestly know the answer there. But I do know that switching to veganism after you've got some mileage on you isn't always possible nutritionally. So that would be one thought. I don't think that your girlfriend is doing anything wrong. It's hard to maintain the vegan lifestyle, and it's difficult to do it well nutritionally. So if she's a sophisticated vegan and she's doing it well and she's getting the adequate amounts of B12, which you just cannot get from vegetables, and she's getting balanced amino acids from her plant products, then I'm like, go you. She probably is doing a lot of good for herself. As a physician, practically speaking, I don't expect the world to go vegan. So I have to work with what's doable for people, what they're likely to do. You see what I'm saying?
I do. Yeah, she switched at age 31, and she is remarkably disciplined.
I like that study, and I have to chase down the actual article because I just read a reference to it. But I want to pursue that study where they looked at health food store shoppers who were either omnivores or vegans, and I want to see what factors they identified and what they tested and what the lag time was, because I don't have all of the specifics on that. But it seems to me that there are a lot of other variables involved in terms of pesticides and contaminants and animal viruses and preservatives and hormones and associated health behaviors that play a role in survival. And so the epidemiologic studies tend to have a lot of the third variable confounds that make me wonder if they're really, for example, the factor that Colin Campbell is picking out is he's picking out animal protein. But I've seen a study that someone did where they're like, oh, it's peanuts are evil because of the aflatoxin. And I always get a little nervous at anybody who's found an evil food, because I think our bodies are really pretty good at adapting to natural foods. It's when we start giving them unnatural foods with preservatives and with nitrates and with processing and the attendant mixing of compounds that comes up with that. That's when I wonder if we're not really messing with our physiology at a deep level. You see what I mean?
I do. But let me ask, did the size of the China study, and off the top of my head, I can't remember if it was hundreds of thousands or or well, even a,
it was, a million. It was a very large epidemiologic study, but again, it was done in China, so the questions and the ascertainment weren't all that specific. They pretty much, there's some assumptions there in terms of what people were eating. And I don't think they controlled for cigarette smoking in that study, which I consider a huge flaw.
That would be.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your input.
Thank you very much. I'll make sure my girlfriend listens to your podcast.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.
All right, and we have Bruce in Prunedale waiting to get on the air. Hello, Bruce, and thank you for waiting.
No problem. Good morning. We have a company that sells products to people dealing with renovation of the homes where the lead paint is a problem, and so we've been more involved since 2010 when the APA basically has put together very tough regulations and very high fines in the tens of thousands of dollars for people that go into a home and don't follow proper procedures to avoid the release of lead into the environment because of the damage to children. But it's really any house built before 1978 is going to have lead paint in it. It's guaranteed. And the problem is more one of exposure to the lead paint when it's disturbed. And it can be little things like having a vacuum even going in and hitting a baseboard. You can release it over the toddlers where they can be chewing on a windowsill and getting the lead paint from the windowsill. But all you can really do safely is to encapsulate it by putting more paint on it to seal it. And I can see where inside of a kitchen cabinet is an area that seldom gets repainted, so it could have very old paint and definitely paint with lead in it.
And definitely paint that's deteriorating, and so turning to dust, literally.
Yeah, so just repainting the cabinets and the trim of the house and everything else would be the safest way to go, because anything else you try to do to remediate is going to release more into the air than you probably want in the first place. But the other is that these kits that they have generate both false positives and false negatives, which is where the EPA doesn't, you know, basically allow them to be used. You have to actually send a sample into a lab. So they can be better than nothing, but there's two basic kits. They use two different types of chemicals, sodium sulfide one and redesonate on the other. You really want to get both types of kits and then try the two, and then you'll get better confirmation as to whether you have a problem.
Do you have any trade names for the two kits in off the top of your head?
They should say what they have in them. But it's mainly that there would be to look at multiple ones and not necessarily believe that it's just because it gives you a says it's a problem, it may or may not be, or that it's negative, it may or may not be. But the other would be to look, mention cookware, but the other would be toys, which, of course, it's been in the news about stuff coming in from China where they do have lead paint on toys. And again, those are more likely to end up in a child's mouth.
Oh, yeah. Toys are a big issue. Thank you for pointing that out. I should have mentioned that as well.
Anybody in a pre-78 home, they have lead, and you need to be careful of just thinking something you're doing something innocuous like sanding before painting. It's something you want to think twice about if you have young children.
Well, thank you very much for calling and pointing those things out. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Dr.
Well, as you can see, this is a huge issue and one which passes kind of under the radar in most of our awareness. But we're having a great discussion here on Ask Dr. Don today. Let's talk to Helen in Santa Cruz. She wants to pick up on some of our themes. Hello, Helen. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. One of the things when you were talking about carnitine and the TMO, I eat very healthy and take a lot of supplements and all that. Only eat pasture-fed animals and dairy. But I'm wondering if there's any immediate supplements to take as an antidote when I do eat my pasture-fed animals or sometimes dairy. So that's one question.
Okay. Well, let me answer that one first. Whenever we eat anything, but particularly if we eat something that has saturated fat in it, we get what's called an oxidative burst in our system, which is pro-inflammatory. Mm-hmm. And so you can measure it, actually. And there are fig glue and a couple of other compounds, one called 8-OMG, which I don't remember. OMG, I can't remember what it means. And anyway, point being, vitamin C and vitamin E, particularly the mixed tocopherols, if they're consumed with the meal, mitigate that oxidative burst. And
right.
So just for starters, eat some vegetables with your, I'm sure you do, with your pasture fit.
Yes.
But vegetables themselves, because they contain vitamin E and vitamin C, are a great antidote against that oxidative burst, and they substantially mitigate it. There's just so much to be said for fruits and vegetables. I mean, they're what we are supposed to be eating, maybe with the occasional bit of meat thrown in, depending on whether you're a paleo or a vegan. But nevertheless, a diet that is grounded in fruits and vegetables is the healthiest diet to consume.
Absolutely.
So that would be my response there. As far as this, the L-carnitine TMAO thing, like I said, in the first part, I've spent enough time on it. I just don't think the data's there to get too excited about that one yet.
Right, but yeah, I've had leaky gut, and sometimes when I eat even pasture-fed animals, I can feel icky afterward. And so the extra added, even with vegetables, the extra added C and E, I can try.
Okay, good.
The other question I have is about coffee. Since you mentioned there are no evil foods, and I don't see it to be an evil food at all. In fact, it's my greatest friend. But I've had controversy, and especially around people who insist that from a functional medicine standpoint, coffee is bad. So I am wondering, is coffee always bad? Like 2 cups? I'm talking about organic coffee, organic fair trade.
Organic coffee in moderation in a person who is sleeping well.
Mm-hmm.
And not experiencing any of the adrenal collapse symptoms,
right,
like crash in your energy in the afternoon, or insomnia, salt cravings, dizziness when standing.
Well, crash in the energy in the afternoon is why I have my second cup of coffee.
Well, then, you know, maybe you should check out your adrenals first, because the reason that functional medicine people don't like caffeine or coffee is great from the antioxidant standpoint. It's an excellent antioxidant. It's got tons of very healthy flavonoids in it, but it does have this caffeine, and caffeine improves your athletic performance and it improves your brain functioning. But there's a price to that. You know, it's a stimulant. And when you overstimulate a system repeatedly, you tend to exhaust it. And in the case of the adrenals, we are an adrenally exhausted society. We stimulate our sympathetic nervous systems. We do not support our parasympathetic nervous system. So our entire culture and our environment is skewed towards hyperstimulation.
Uh-huh.
And so people tend to develop adrenal deficiency, and one of the things I do if someone has any of the signs of adrenal deficiency, and that would include the afternoon energy drop, by the way. It's not definitive, it's a symptom, and there are other things that can cause that, like sleep apnea, but still, it's one of the things I listen for. And if I hear it, you know, I'm like, yeah, maybe you should try going without coffee, taper yourself off, go without coffee for a couple of months, switch to green tea in the morning for your caffeine, and see what happens with your energy and with that lull in the afternoons, or get your adrenals checked out by a qualified naturopath or a functional medicine doctor, and get yourself assessed.
So I have a quick question, and I'm talking about supplement antidotes, because I know it's a longer issue. I've tried to get off coffee before, and I just don't function well, even with the best naturopaths.
Mm-hmm. And when you tapered yourself.
Is there an antidote supplement that supports adrenals, like ginseng or something, that you could recommend for me when I just have two cups?
No, I wouldn't, because I think
you wouldn't do that.
Well, it's just that it's much more sophisticated than that. And I go into the health food store and I see these, you know, adrenal tonics, and, you know, they've got rhodiola, they've got ashwagandha, they've got that and the other thing. And it's really much more nuanced than that. And so there is no one-size-fits-all answer.
Mm-hmm. When you say it's more nuanced than that, do you have specific tests that you would take to say then, okay, rhodiola would be the antidote for you, or something would be the antidote?
They're not really antidotes. I don't even like that word, right, Helen, because it implies it has a drug-like perspective.
Yes.
And these things are not drugs. These are agents that helps. They really are support agents.
Yes.
You're trying to support an organ, not beat it to death, not squeeze more juice out of it. And
absolutely,
that's why really you should look at this as far as the caffeine's concerned, and the coffee, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you do need to do some work with somebody, do some more definitive work. I don't know. But there isn't an antidote or a specific agent that I would recommend. You know what they are. There's ginseng.
Yeah.
There's ashwagandha, or with they name somniferum.
Yeah.
There's rhodiola. There's bacoba. There's Eleutheria, which is Siberian ginseng. Those are the compounds that are used in various, various amounts. Holy basil is another one. And they all have legitimate agency working with the adrenal glands and helping support the physiology. But it really does require a little bit more analysis to figure out what's going to be the right thing for the right person.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye. I only have a chance to get to a couple of emails. I wanted to just respond to Tom in Woodbridge, Illinois. Tom writes, component in a brown rice brand suppresses a type of cancer. Thank you for your show. I listen every week. I heard you speak about brown rice brand last week. Very interesting. Here is a 2007 poster abstract from an immunology meeting that mentions a component in brown rice brand that suppresses a specific type of cancer. Tom, I went to the link and read the poster abstract, and again, it's the devil's in the details on these things, but this was a compound that's found in brown rice bran. And what they did was they gave it by injection in very, very high doses to mice that had been infected with a cancer, basically, as cancer was inserted under the skin of the mice. And then they looked at differences in the tumor growth rate and showed that it didn't grow as fast in the animals that had that injection. Again, this is taking a substance and kind of doing this drug mentality to it, which is not necessarily a natural thing, and is, you know, basically they're data mining, trying to get research money to look for possible cancer cures, because there's money in getting possible cancer cures. So it's still feeding into that cancer industrial complex that we seem to be trapped in right now. And actually that comes to Ralph in Santa Cruz, who wrote, there's so much advertising in the media promoting businesses that focus on treating cancer patients. Can you give us your general take on what these medical businesses are and their value to cancer patients? And again, like I was saying just a minute ago, we're trapped in a cancer industrial complex, and some of the large hospitals like MD Anderson and in Texas have become these sort of centers for excellence, and indeed they are excellent for their sophistication and their willingness to subject people to all kinds of crazy therapies to keep them alive. Some of these businesses are natural businesses that are doing alternative therapy for cancer. I believe that alternative therapy for cancer, which is nutrition-based, is very legitimate. I'm not so sure about some of the things that are done, but I think a lot can be done with diet. And when you support a healthy diet, I think you make a difference in changing the terrain of the cancer. In other words, changing the environment in which those cancer cells are living. And just as we have the gut flora, and how we eat influences our gut flora profoundly, and our gut flora influences the state of our health, well, the same thing. If you have cancer cells that are sort of hibernating or being held in check by the immune system, and you have a pro-inflammatory environment, you have an environment that suppresses immunity, then the chances of those cancer cells being able to successfully wake up and thrive are greater. And we know from both lab experiments and animal experiments that there are things you can do with diet that influence the rate that cancers grow. So some of those commercial institutions are probably very legitimate, and I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer for that one. We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. It's been really fun, and this is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.